CataractCoach.com, podcast number 26 with Brandon Ayers. Brandon is a professor and surgeon at the Wills Eye Hospital and their network in the Philadelphia area. He's a fantastic surgeon for complex anterior segment cases. On his typical OR day, half or more than half of the patients are complicated anterior segment cases. He has a great YouTube channel that we're going to link below. You can also check out his videos and you'll learn a lot from how to approach these difficult cases and successfully complete them, all for our patient's benefit. In fact, we even discuss a step-by-step approach to the patient with a cataract and loose Zimmer support. I think you'll really enjoy it. Check it out. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Dr. Brandon Ayers from the Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia. I've been a big fan of Brandon's for a very long time because of his very complex cataract surgery cases. Now, I'm an expert in the average cataract case, and I'm pretty darn good in the very complicated ones, but sometimes I need to learn the extra little tricks and pearls and maneuvers that help you get through those incredibly challenging cases. So tonight we're gonna talk to Brandon Ayers, and we're gonna delve into his path in ophthalmology, how do we approach these challenging cases, and let's just take a step back and go step by step and understand the thinking process for attempting one of these tough cases. Brandon, welcome. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're going to have a great time. And I've watched a lot of your videos. And you know what's funny? Probably my favorite videos of yours don't even involve surgical footage. They're where you're using like a model eye and showing with like yarn how to tie this suture, how to suture. Tell me about all this stuff. You've got some incredible material out there.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we both have a hobby or a passion for making videos and a passion for teaching. And I like to try and show simple but maybe creative ways of how to tackle a problem or to take something that's very difficult to maybe explain and put it into pictures or a simple model so that if somebody is trying to look something up or wants to learn something, they can watch that video. We can break it down into very simple pieces and they can remember it. So it's not a very long, you know, it's not an hour long with, a chalkboard and, you know, math equations. It's just I get it. This is just like tying a shoelace, you know? And so once you get into the operating room, you can remember how to do it. And it's not as complicated as you probably thought it was. So, and some of those videos are some of the most watched that I have on YouTube.
Right.
And they're not the ones that I thought. They're the simple one question, one answer. This is how you do it. Now go do it in the operating room kind of videos.
Well, I've got to admit, I've watched like your simple model with like shoelaces or yarn of like, here's how you throw this complex suture. I've watched that one video like maybe 20 or 30 times in a row just to have it sink into my head. And it's so much easier to see like the shoelaces being tied as opposed to a 10-0 proline.
Yep. Yep. And that's because those don't transfer very well on surgical video. You know, we'll be at a meeting, maybe it's AAO or ASCRS or a different meeting, and you're showing this complex case and you can just see the whole audience is like, looking at your screen, like I don't get what you're doing. So, in some of those videos, we use literally it's yarn or masonry line or something that's very bright. And I'm down in my basement, like taking a coat hanger and trying to make a CIF4 or a straight needle out of it. You know, trying to figure out what I've got to make these models. But then you can actually see it. And sometimes I'll even try and match that model up with the surgical video, so you see the model. And then you see it in the operating room. So you can kind of see where some of the differences are. But wait, I've got something special for you. Give me one second. Hang on.
Oh, I would love, I want to see it. While he's bringing that, let me just tell you, I subscribe to Brandon's videos on YouTube. And I'm going to put a link down below. If you want to check it out, I highly recommend it. Look, that's the model. I've
it's
seen
right
that
here.
Before.
Yeah,
that's
here
the
it
model.
Is. So for I those, keep these.
For those who are only listening on the Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Google, Brandon now is showing on video here the actual big model of the eye that's probably, you know, 30 centimeters in diameter, and he uses big yarn or big string to show how to tie the sutures.
So people, I'll get comments on YouTube as to, you know, where do I get this model eye that you're using? And this is two paper plates. That's all it is. So here's it's two paper plates, and I cut the top out of one of them. The iris, the artificial iris here, is a sock that I bought at CVS, and I cut a hole in it, and I glued it in there. And then I spray painted the back plate red for a red reflex. My needle, my CIF-4, that is a hanger. Yep. And this, the proline suture is masonry line that I bought at Home Depot. I've got like 500 yards of it. You can have all that you want. I'll never need all of it. But that's my paper plate. But I'll still use this sometimes when I am when I have a case and I'm trying to figure out how am I going to get all of this done. I think some people think that you've kind of mastered this, or you can just do this, and you can't. I still will sit down with that plate or a drawing or another model, and I'm like, wait, I need to do a lens exchange, a vitrectomy, an iris repair, and maybe somehow even do a cornea. And how am I going to get all that done without my incisions getting in the way of each other? Or how am I going to organize this so that in the operating room things flow smoothly? And you have to sit down sometimes and just sort of do a dry run, do a practice, go to the wet lab. I'm down here in my basement, and just sort of do a couple of mental experiments. Even when you've got a lot of experience, you still have to sometimes step back and practice, and figure out what's going to happen that you don't. Yeah, because the last thing you want to do is waste time or delay in the operating room. These cases take a while, and if I can cut 5 or 10 minutes off just by doing some mental practice beforehand, it's well worth it.
Wow, that's good to know, because I'm like you. I'm tens of thousands of cases into my career, very established. But when I have a challenging case, I do the exact same thing. I do think about it a lot. The night before surgery, I look at my surgical lineup, and that one tough case coming up is the one I lie there in bed with my eyes closed. I think about that case, and I kind of go through the steps. What am I going to do here, here, and here? And yep. I watch your videos like clockwork. Like I said earlier, I'm going to put a link down below. Please subscribe to Brandon's videos. I watch them all the time.
I wonder, Uday, if our patients know sometimes that we lose sleep over their case the night before. Because I do the same thing.
Right.
If I know I've got a big case coming up, and how am I going to do this? And especially, for me, especially if it's a young patient. I mean, all patients deserve great care. But when grandma's coming in and she's 90 years old, I want that patient to see, I want grandma to see really well. But I know that the stakes are higher when my patient is 7 years old or 5 years old or 1 year old. I'm like, boy, the whole future for this patient's vision relies on what I do. And man, I just, it's so much respect for the parents and the family who, when they meet me and trust us with the future of their family or their kids, that's gotta be terrible as a parent, when your children are going through these cases. But I can't sleep. I sit there and I'm like, what if this, what if that? And even as I go to sleep, I'm running what if I hit this complication? What about that complication? How am I going to manage this? How am I going to manage that? What if this happens? Maybe, that never ends. If you're thinking, do you ever stop some of that nervous excitement? I'm not sure what you call that, Uday, but I'm not scared, but I think I'm respectfully nervous for the patient.
Yeah, I think the same way. Back when I was teaching residents at our big county hospital, I did a lot of the pediatric lensectomy cases or pediatric cases. These are babies who are a month old. And I really want to treat that patient, that 1 month-old baby, like my own child, like my own baby. And so you're right. I would prepare to the nth degree. I'd sleep early that night. I'd think about their case constantly. And when I go there in the operating room, it's got to be perfect. I really want to deliver that care because, you're right. What you do that day, that person's going to see through. That baby who's a month old now is going to see through your surgery for 90 more years.
Yeah. It's a lot of responsibility, man.
It really is. And then for some of the adult patients with these complex issues, honestly, I tell patients, I'd say, I'm happy to do your surgery, but just know in advance that your surgery is going to take a week off my life. I'm okay with that. Because I'm going to put it that it was going to cause me some stress. I'm going to think about it a lot. But I want to accept the challenge. And I want to give you my very, very best.
Yeah. You're like, I'm giving you a week of my life. That's what I will give to you.
Honestly, with some of these very challenging cases, I got to tell you, we are giving a piece of ourselves that patient. We're taking time off. It's incredible stress. Stakes are so high, and the margin of error is like infinitesimally small.
Yep. 6 microns, you know, that's the margin of error.
Right. So these cases are wild. So, I mean, so obviously you're very respectful of the patient. You think about it a lot, but a lot of our viewers email, and our viewers are in general 30s and 40s on Cataract Coach, and they ask, I have a very challenging case coming up, and I've done a couple thousand cases. I'm pretty comfortable, but how do I get in the correct kind of mindset to tackle that tough case? I've never done a case like this before.
Well, I think you never say no. I mean, the first time I try something new is always the most stressful,
right,
case, you know, of that day, because it's a new technique or it's a new problem or it's something unique. And I've always been someone to just say, you know what, don't say no. Now, you never want to go into a complex case without preparation. But it's okay if that's the first time that you've performed that procedure live, you know, on that patient.
Right.
I never practice on patients, right? We practice in the wet lab. We do mental practice. We do all this preparation for those cases. You go into the operating room and you perform. So you perform on that patient. You don't practice. But that doesn't mean that you haven't practiced. You know, wet labs, talking to a friend, going to YouTube. You can learn so much on YouTube. In fact, that's why and I'm not knocking other platforms, but that's why I put my videos on YouTube. So if you're in the operating room and you're like, oh, shoot, how do I do this? There's no logging in. There's no nothing. You just go to YouTube, search up something. Hopefully, you know, one of our videos shows up and you can watch it and then sit back down and do the over. There's no usernames or passwords, although I think some of mine are youth restricted because they're kind of gory. So you got to put your age in, I guess. But that's why we do it, so that you have that support going into the operating room. You've seen a case, you've watched it, you've heard maybe our thoughts, or Uday, maybe you have a good video, people have heard your thoughts, and you can tackle that case. But I think there'd be something wrong with you if you weren't a little bit nervous doing that case. I think that's respectful. You know, you're you're not just going in there guns blazing. You've got some trepidation, and it's going to keep you on your toes, and you're going to take some extra caution during that case.
I think you're right. If you come into a tough case a little bit nervous, you know what? You're treating from the heart. You're a good doctor.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah. Exactly. I believe it. And then once you tackle that one unique case, and then you go, oh, okay, I learned a lot that case. And then you can apply it to the next time or a similar case. And suddenly you've built this library of complex cases, and they just build one on the other. And that allows you to combine complex techniques or you know, combine ideas. And suddenly you're doing these, you know, very complex cases, and you're making them look relatively simple. But it's only because you have a lot of experience. In fact, I've been so blessed and gifted that, you know, I work, you know, in Philadelphia, primarily at Wills Eye Hospital. And there's a lot of surgeons who really, maybe wisely, don't want to tackle these cases. They do take longer. You are taking more risks and the stakes are higher. So I've basically built my career saying, okay, let's do that. You know, someone's got to help you. Let it be me. And we just have just case. For example, today, Uday, in our OR today, we pretty much did over half the cases were lens exchanges or had lens exchange, iris repair, or vitrectomy. So most of our cases are complex.
More than half were complex.
Right. So, but that's because we say yes, or I say yes. And now I can make a day of those cases. And it's not, granted, it's not like I didn't walk in there and I was like, yeah, baby, lens exchanges all day long. But you don't hit the panic button.
Right.
And we get so much practice because we say yes that it makes you better. But I never think that I am a better surgeon than somebody else. In fact, in many ways, I think, you know, I've learned from great people. I think they're better surgeons than me. But we get an awful lot of practice with these cases, and practice and experience and performing in the operating room adds up over time, and you can tackle these cases with a little bit less fear and trepidation with volume.
Oh, I think that's some great points. You know, my goal is, the old model was, okay, all the doctors in the community, you just do the routine cases, and anything out of the routine, anything more complicated or more complex, refer it out. I don't think we need to do that anymore. I think with the advent of this kind of learning platform, we can teach that, yes, you young doctor in the community who has a passion for learning and wanting to give your patients the best, you can learn these techniques. Let me show you all my pearls. Yeah. And one of the key things on Cataract Coach is I give away all the secrets, all the pearls. There's nothing hidden. Every single secret or pearl I know, it's yours for the having. Have it.
Well, Cataract Coach is just an amazing resource, and the amount of work that you put into that is phenomenal. I try and put out a video a week, and over the summer I get a little bit lazy because I'm busy doing stuff with kids. Yeah. A video every day is unbelievable. I've talked to you about this. It's unbelievable. I can't believe it. So kudos to you. That is such a dedication. And you're right. It's free information. A new case every day, a new complex issue, just maybe tackling just that one thing. You know, here's something new that you can learn today. Yeah. Great job, Uday. I love it.
What year did you finish your residency?
I finished residency in 2004.
Okay, so I'm 4 years ahead of you. I finished residency in 2000. People don't know, back in the day, there was no YouTube video. There's nothing existed. We had to hunt down VHS copies. VHS means it's a plastic box that has like a magnetic tape in it, and it shows low definition video. We had VHS tapes of like Bobby Osher's video journal, and we learned from those. But today in the modern world is from your smartphone, you can watch high definition video of literally any surgical case you can even think of.
Yeah, I was in the basement of Wills Eye Hospital the other day in the audio view department, and somebody brought in a reel to reel video that they wanted to convert reel to reel. I'm like, how did you get reel to reel video of surgery? How on earth did you bring in a whole like video camera and you're in there?
Well, I got to explain to the young audience here, because we have a lot of like 30 something years. Reel to reel is, there's a reel of film, of actual plastic magnetic film. The reel is about, let's say, 30 centimeters in diameter, and it goes to another reel, and it's like the predecessor to VHS. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. It's old. It's really old, and it melts, and you got to tape it together, and man, oh, man, that was great.
Like when people say, oh, yeah, that part of the video ended up on the cutting room floor. You're like, but how? It's all digital. No, literally, it was actually plastic magnetic film that they would physically cut and physically tape together, and the scraps would be on the floor of the cutting room. That's why it's called the cutting room. They cut the film.
And now you can just take your your GoPro Hero Cam, and you can live stream across the world. It's just unbelievable. But it helps us. I mean, it makes us better.
It does. I mean, it's the way I learned DMEC was from watching others. I didn't do a cornea fellowship. And even if I did do a cornea fellowship back in the year 2000, they didn't know how to spell DMEC back then, let alone do it.
So Uday, what do you do today, okay, that I asked that all kinds of wrong. What do you do today that you didn't learn in residency?
Everything that I do today, I didn't learn residency. Everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if I operated the same way that I did when I was a resident, you would kick me. I mean, that's like saying to you, Brandon, I want you to use the same computer and cell phone that you used 20 years ago. You're like, what?
Yep. Yeah, same with me, Uday. I mean, I did do a cornea fellowship, and I did my fellowship just at the transition when lamellar surgery, things like DSEC, DMEC wasn't an issue then, but DSEC was sort of coming in. We were doing an older version called DLEC, which was kind of a crash and burn. I did not do suture lenses. We did not do iris repairs. We didn't do iris prosthesis. We didn't do most of what I've based my career on. And I think I remember walking down the hallway of Wills Eye Hospital the last day of my fellowship. I did my cornea fellowship at Wills Eye, and I've been there, you know, since then. But walking down the hallway thinking, man, I don't think I've learned it all yet. Like, I don't think I should be a cornea specialist. There's still so many questions, but I'm going to be the expert. The residency and fellowship is just the launching pad. That's it.
Right.
You know, right. The rest of your learning still happens. We're still learning. There's still, there's still cases I do. I'm like, man, I'm going to review the tape on that one. I don't think I did it very well. How can I get better?
Right.
Never be satisfied with the way things are. You know, you're always wanting to do something better, do something new, try a new technique, try new technology.
Well, if you want a good laugh, you can laugh at me, because back when I was a senior resident, it was June of my senior year, June of 2000, I was just about to graduate. And I was dumber than a bucket of rocks. So I said to myself, oh, I can't wait till I'm in practice. It'll be so much easier because I already know everything. And yep. Now you look back, you're like, what kind of fools is that? This fool right here, this guy.
Well, you know, we all thought that. I mean, we thought that residency gets you ready for practice. It just gets you ready for the beginning. That's right.
It's literally the bare bones. You say the launching pad. I say the foundation. But it's the bare building, you know, building blocks of what you're going to do. But you're going to teach yourself every year for the entirety of your career.
Yep. And I'm not finished yet myself. I mean, you know. If people like what I do, great. Like, the video is fantastic, but we are always working on ourselves, trying to make ourselves better and do better. And, you know, something that I see, and we teach fellows almost every day. I have a fellow with me, I'd say about 90% of the time. Don't be afraid to try something a little bit different, intentionally do things a little bit different. Tear your capsular rexus the other way. Don't go clockwise, go counterclockwise. Try starting the rexus with a different instrument. Try, you know, don't be afraid to make a second paracentesis if you're having trouble, you know, with access with your first paracentesis. Try bimanual IA. It lets you use both hands. You see somebody with a small iris defect that might be easy to repair? Go ahead and repair it. Do it. Yeah. Don't say, oh, that'd be cool to repair. Repair it. You know, start small. Get the building block, and then you build on that. And so be willing to say, yeah, I'll try that, or yes, I'll do it. And definitely don't be afraid of trying something a little bit differently than, you know, we all hear the voices of our attendings and our teachers in our ear. And, you know, this is how you do it. This is how you do it. Well, it really should be, this is how I do it. There's lots of ways of doing things. And don't be afraid to think outside the box. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't have all these cool and innovative techniques where you're like, huh, I didn't think of that, but I should have. Is that a lot of them aren't difficult. It's just someone had to finally say, let's do it. Even remember a round capsular rexus was a new idea at some point. Now you're like, well, how else did you do it? And it was all can openers. And then finally someone's like, hey, let's make this round. It'll make things better. It's amazing. You know, one little thing, it's simple, but it changed the world as far as ophthalmic surgery and ocular surgery goes.
Well, I think it's a great point. You've got to constantly evolve your thinking surgically and evolve the field. When I taught residents, and I retired last year at age 52 because I had an amazing run, and it's time to pass the baton to someone younger, someone straight out of training. But I would tell the residents, we're going to do a case today. I'm going to teach you my way. And my way is my best way of doing it today. I may not do it the same way in 5 or 10 years. And you may think of a better way of doing it. So at any point during today's surgery, if you say, you know, it occurs to me that this would be a better way than what you're teaching me, just say it and let's try your way. And literally, that's how things evolved. Yeah, you're right. It used to be not only Canberra capsulotomy, there was something called a Christmas tree capsulotomy. All the 30 and 40 something were off the market. Like, what? Christmas
tree capsulotomy? Yeah. Oh, who?
Yeah. But yeah, then went to capsulorexis. And then, yeah, so all these things kind of evolve with time. And so, yeah, if you're doing a case that you're attending and you say, I think there's a different way that may be better, please, whoever you are, young resident, young Jedi, say something to your attending and go from there.
Yeah, I agree. And I get spoiled by being able to operate with new fellows each year that come from all over the country. And so we definitely, or I definitely back learn from them. I'm like, right. Oh, no, that's different, you know, but okay. Different is not bad. Different is probably good. And sometimes, you know, I say the eye speaks to you. Like, how are you going to tackle this cataract? I'm like, I don't know. Let's see what happens. You know, maybe we're going to flip and chip. Maybe we're going to chop. Maybe it's divide and conquer. Let's see what it looks like. So having all these little differences in technique can sometimes mm-hmm. be just what you need to get you out of a jam when things aren't working the way that you're trying to get it to work. Sometimes you got to sit back and say, okay, I think this cataract is going to come out better using, you know, stop and chop or divide and conquer.
Right.
You can't always force it to go your way. You've got to kind of go with the flow, and that's okay. Let that be all right. So the more techniques you can master, or the more techniques you can know, the better off you're going to be, because sometimes you're going to have to shift into second gear or shift up to third gear and try something a little bit different.
Yeah, some great points. I also like the concept that it's okay to do the best you can and then enlist the help of your colleagues. Very recently on Cataract Coach, we had a case where a surgeon was referred a white cataract to do. And this surgeon, he or she, does a beautiful job, puts in a Malugin ring, expands the pupil, there's a white cataract. The patient had a prior vitrectomy, goes in to do the cataract surgery, and it's like, oh, there's just cortex. It's like kind of nothing there. And then silicone oil starts popping up.
Yep.
And this, so obviously in this case, the when the vitrectomy was done, the vitreal surgeon inadvertently hit the back of the capsule, the lens ends up falling in the vitreous, and when the patient was sent to the cataract surgeon, there was just white cortex remaining. But I love that this surgeon just said, hey, let me clean up what I can, which is the cortex. Let me put in a sulcus lens optic captured securely. And let me just send it back to a vitreal colleague. So it's okay to not be like the complete hero. You don't have to fish in the vitreous cavity with the phaco probe. In fact, you shouldn't.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's your job to take care of the problem at hand. You know, and if that's what the eye gives you, you do your job. And that's why we have other specialists and we have colleagues, because it's better for the patient. It's safer for the patient. That's happened to myself as well. It's a case comes to mind. It's, a patient who's had probably hundreds of intravitreal injections. And every once in a while, that needle can maybe hit the posterior capsule. And, you know, we started with our normal techniques, made a capsulorexis and hydrodissected. And right then. You're like, okay, this is going south.
Boom.
You know, it's gone. You're like, well, okay. You know, we had talked to this patient. You know, we knew that this cataract was bad, and we said sometimes it takes more than one surgery to get these cataracts out, and that's the case here. Cleaned up the cortex that was left, but you know what? These are great opportunities for us to do maybe a technique that we don't usually get to do. So in this case, the vitrectomy. Right.
Right.
We know we got to do it. We've got a round anterorexis. So I'm like, let's just do the best vitrectomy that we can today. That's our job for this patient. Let's make sure there's no vitreous prolapse. Let's make sure we get all that cortex cleaned up. Now we're no longer afraid. Hey, you know what? Let's put some triamcinolone in. Let's see what happens when you put triamcinolone in. You can visualize the vitreous better.
Right.
So right then, you've now taken probably the number one procedure that anterior segment surgeons are afraid of or feel least comfortable with, vitrectomy, because most of the time we do a good job and we don't have to do it, but sometimes you do. So you do that vitrectomy, you're no longer afraid of it, you've done it, two-port vitrectomy, you don't have to go pars plana. You know, if you're not comfortable, don't go pars plana.
Yeah.
But use triamcinolone, separate infusion and your vitrector. Vitrect until nothing comes forward anymore. Clean up the cortex, lens goes in the sulcus with optic capture, and it's a win. That patient will do absolutely fine because you sat back, You didn't panic. You did what you had to do, and you learned something in that case. You feel more comfortable with vitrectomy. Mm-hmm. See vitreous again. Hey, I've done this. Not a big deal. Give me some triamcinolone. Let me do the vitrectomy until the vitreous stops coming forward. So even these disaster cases that we go home and we're like, oh, let me call my buddy Uday and tell him what happened today in the OR. You'll learn from those, and you become better surgeons because of it. None of us get that much better doing the same thing over and over and over.
Correct.
You get faster, but you didn't learn much that day. You know, these challenging cases where you had to zig and zag that you learn something new. So, you know, my day's not vanilla ice cream all day long. I don't brush my teeth 50 times during the day. You know, I got to brush my teeth. I got to comb my hair and, you know, and do a couple different things. So,
yeah, you've got to push the envelope. And then remember, anyone who's listening here, just tell your vitreoretinal colleague, cataract coach says that we need to share the love and the liability with our vitreoretinal colleagues. Yeah. It's from the heart. But no, you're right. It's absolutely a team effort there. Now, I wanted to ask you about this. You got an average cataract surgeon who's out there doing a beautiful job, has done a lot of surgeries, like me, is used to routine cases, but knows that there's a challenging case coming up. So I'll give you a little case scenario. And what I want to know from you is not how you do it, but what advice you can give to this other doctor who's in the community, how to take a step back, how to approach the case, and how to succeed here. So you got a patient, let's say, make some numbers up, 80 years old, 3+ NS, you see the patient in the clinic, at the slit lamp, a very shallow AC of like 2 millimeters, pupil only dilates about 4 millimeters, and you see a lot of pseudoexfoliation. But the axial length is 24. So you got a 2 millimeter deep AC in an eye that's a 24 millimeter axial length. And now it's time to do this patient's surgery. You see this patient on the pre-op day in the surgery center. The nurses put the IV, they put all the drops in, and again, the max dilation you get, even with 10% phenylephrine, is a 4 millimeter pupil. Now, what goes through your mind, like you bring that patient back to the OR, okay, doctor, go for it. How should Joe Average, which is me also, how do you approach that case? Step by step.
Yeah, you're not Joe Average, but you know. So this is the stuff that nightmares are made of, right? This is the case that I'm losing sleep over that night because so many things are wrong, and that exam shows you so much, right? You've got a normal to maybe slightly myopic, you know, patient who should have probably a deep chamber, but it's shallow,
right.
Bad pseudoexfoliation, small pupil. So you're probably going to be dealing with, you know, some kind of pupil dilating device. You're probably going to have a zonulopathy right off the bat. Pseudoexfoliation is difficult to deal with because you have weak zonules that get weaker and break more as you go, as opposed to some other zonulopathies or, say, traumatic zonulopathy where what's broken is broken, but what's good is good.
Well, that's a key point. Oh, my gosh. In fact, I don't think we emphasize that enough. Could you say that again? So it's, the zonulopathy is likely to become worse during surgery.
Right. Yep.
Compared to a traumatic case, it'll be the same.
Right. So your goal is to, you know, once you get access to that lens, try to minimize the progressive nature of that zonulopathy because the zonules were strong enough to hold the lens at least somewhat in place, you know, and so hopefully they're strong enough to hold the IOL in place. But man, there's a lot of stress going from that first incision till the end of that case when you're, you know, when you don't want any leaky wounds to shallow the AC where you could think you've won the game and all of a sudden the lens floats off into the vitreous. And I've had that happen where you know, you think you're the hero and suddenly you're like, nope, now we've got another case. So my tips, I'm talking to my friend who calls me and says, oh man, you know, I know you do these all the time. How do you walk me through this? Well, one, okay, this is not the case you do first thing. Right. This is a case that you save extra time for. Maybe put it towards the end of the day if you can, because it's going to completely throw off your schedule. This will not be a 6-minute phaco or a 10-minute phaco or probably not even a 15 or 20-minute phaco, right? So, and have everything. So we just did it. We just went through that mental experiment. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to deal with a small pupil, zonulopathy. So what do you want in the OR? And I will run around the OR when these cases come up and just get everything. All right.
So let's go through it. So you want a pupil expansion device, maybe iris hooks. What else do you want?
So I'm going to have capsule retractors in that room. I'm going to have a capsule tension ring in the room.
Right.
We're going to have a backup IOL in the room. including
a three-piece lens.
Okay. And I'm probably going to have that patient consented for anterior vitrectomy. I do that for most of our patients who are at high risk with zonulopathy. Not that we're going to do it, but that we may do it that way. And the reason is, it's high risk in this patient. You've got to discuss it with them.
Right.
And now, if you have to go on and do a vitrectomy, it's no longer a complication. It's a planned part of that surgery, which is true. I mean, you know, I talked to the patient about this.
Right.
We're not pulling any punches here. I think that that vitrectomy belongs in that consent form. If you don't need it, you don't do it.
Now, do you still topical anesthesia intracameral, or you do a block?
Well, I still do these topical, believe it or not, but we've done a lot of them. I would suggest to my buddy, you know what, at least do a peribulbar block. The last thing you need is a patient, you know, it's longer case, they start moving, they start squeezing.
That can be the difference.
That can be the difference. Although I'm very, impressed now. A lot of our fellows are not that comfortable with retrobulbar blocks. We do a lot of blocks for complex cases and corneal transplants. Yeah. So it's not a big deal for me to perform an RB block prior to surgery. But not everybody's comfortable with it. But I would say at least a peribulbar block. And if you feel you could do an RB, I would do it.
There are good videos on Cataract Coach of exactly how to do a retrobulbar injection.
There you go.
You gotta watch the video. But no, I think you're right. Listen, the path of least grief is let the patient be comfortable. The mistake is thinking that, look, that one drop of tetracaine I put on is not going to last an hour, I promise you.
Right.
Not going to last the hour.
Yeah. This is gonna take longer. And you're already starting to count them up. Okay, I've got my paracentesis. I've got my main wound. I've got three or four to make for potential capsule hooks. You got to make sure that you've got this organized so that you're not putting paracentesis on top of paracentesis and getting leaky wounds throughout the case. So this is one that I may even draw out, pre-op, just to see where is it gonna go? How's everything gonna fit?
It's funny you say draw out, because I do the exact same thing, and I literally put a picture of the eyeball on a piece of paper, taped to the microscope, and I draw out in advance, where do I want to make all these incisions?
Yeah. That's because you've done it before, and you know it can be difficult to fit all these in. I think sometimes that shows experience, and you don't just go in there and wing it. You've got to have these things planned out, you know? And here, obviously, the zonulopathy in the case you gave me is going to be the major issue. Is, you know, when do you put a hook in? When do you put a capsular tension ring in? There's plenty of surgeons out there who have never needed to put a capsular tension ring in. Good for you. But even that motion of putting in a CTR can cause anxiety in patients. And I've actually been called into somebody else's OR because they thought they needed a CTR but had never placed one. And it was, you know, bogging up their day and causing them so much anxiety. And I'm like, look, buddy, you're not going to believe how easy this is, you know?
Yeah.
Like, should I use an 11 or a 12? And you're like, it doesn't make a difference. Just put the CTR in and just make sure that capsular bag is filled. But anyway, you get the idea. You know, these surgeries with multiple new techniques, man, that gets stressful for someone who hasn't done it before.
Right.
So, put the hooks in early, very early. As soon as you suspect zonulopathy, those hooks go in. They act as artificial zonules. Take the cataract out, whatever way that cataract wants to come out. Because you know this already, Uday. Those very loose lenses, no matter what technique you use, it's not as smooth as it is in a case with zonules. The lenses don't spin. They don't rotate. They don't crack as easily. It's amazing how much we rely on the zonules to hold things in place. You recognize that when they're not there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's say the same case. You get your pupil expansion device in, whether it's iris hooks or some Malugin ring or some other kind of pupil expansion ring, and you go in and do your Rexus. And you normally do the direction like me, just forceps alone, and you try to poke in the lens capsule, and all it does is wrinkle. You can't even poke in the capsule with your forceps. Now what?
So you want to know what I really do? And that's actually when you know. That's when you know how easy or difficult this case is going to be. You go in with the cystotome, or you go in to try and tear it, and instead of it tearing, it wrinkles, and you just drag the lens in a circle instead of tearing the rexus.
Yes.
So I will usually just stab it with a sharp blade. I just go in through the paracentesis. I just stab it with a sharp blade, which still can be difficult in these severe zonulopathy cases. And then I actually will often start at doing what's called a bimanual capsulorhexis. And I think I may have a video of how to do this on YouTube. I can't really remember. But essentially, I mean, you want to get yourself out of your comfort zone. I use two micro forceps. So stab the capsule, try to get a leaflet to start. I go in one paracentesis with a atraumatic micro forcep. I take a micro rhexis forcep on the other hand, and I hold the lens in place while the other one begins the pterorhexis. And once I get enough started, I'll put a hook in. It's like climbing, like rock climbing. And as you go, you put another carabiner in with a little doohickey. I don't know what they're called. Sorry. But you get the idea. As you go, you start adding your support so that you can make as complete of a capsulorhexis as you can. But there you got to be really creative, and it can take a while, a long while to make that rhexis. And it tends to be small because because you're moving the capsule as you tear the rhexis. And so it's very hard to make a large capsulorhexis. But you know what? You don't always want a very large capsulorhexis in these cases because you need to be able to hold the hooks in and hold the CTR in. So if you get a very large rhexis, the hooks don't hold as well, and it begins to slip out as you're...
Yeah, they pop out.
Yeah. So a little bit small is okay. You can always enlarge it later if you need to.
No, I think that's great. I do the same thing. My two-handed technique is once we stab in, I use a needle, cystotome, a side port blade, whatever it is. Start that erect because I just actually use a chopper in one hand to kind of hold and give counter crack from the capsule.
Yeah.
As we start to tear. But same kind of concept. But you're right. It's like...
Yep. You got to support with one hand and tear with the other. So however you do it is up to you. Yep.
Right. And then for nucleus removal, what do you say there? Just whatever technique works for you?
Yeah, honestly, yes. I love to chop, and I like to cross chop. And so if I can get that first quadrant out, it decompresses the bag a little bit, and you can usually get the other pieces. You can back chop, but it's whatever works. And it kind of depends, on how dense the lens is. Is it soft? Is it dense? But I do whatever the lens speaks to me, honestly, Uday, because they're all a little bit different.
It's like pick up basketball. When you play basketball with your buddies, you just take it as it comes. You may have all kinds of plans, but whatever, just take it.
Yeah, you're right. It's exactly the case. And I've had it. I'm like, this is not working. Whatever I'm doing is, I'm just, give me the viscoelastic. Oh, speaking of OVD, never let those chambers shallow. Treat it like it's a vitreous loss case. Because with all those hooks in, every time that chamber shallows, you can just hear them. Ding, 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 ding. You're breaking more zonules. So every time you come out, OVD goes in. So tell them in advance, hey, go get like 5 OVDs and just stick them in the room. Because we're going to go through them. Because every time you need something, that poor circulator's running down the hall or going out to the fridge. Get that all in there. You're going to make way more friends in the OR by not having them run like crazy. Get it all in there. Anything you think you might need, have it close by. Nobody wants 20,000 steps, one case,
Yeah, one of my favorite sayings on cataract coach, viscoelastic is cheaper than vitreous.
Way cheaper. Yep.
All right, so finally, by some miracle, you get the nucleus out. Now it's time, probably for the hardest part, which is cortex removal. When do you put in the CTR? And then how do you, if the CTR is in and the cortex is there, isn't the CTR going to kind of pull the cortex at the equator and make it hard to remove? How do you do this?
Yeah, good question. And that is definitely a one that I play by feel of the case. With 3 or 4 capsular support hooks, and they really don't inhibit cortical cleanup very much. A CTR can. And I think that there's 2 things that CTRs do. Sometimes they go in and they snap open and they do hold the equatorial cortex in place. Okay. Sometimes they'll actually tunnel underneath or behind the cortex and go around.
And dissect it for you.
And then it dissects it for you, right? And so you're like, how is this cortex coming out so easy? I just put a capsular tension ring in. So you really don't know what you're going to get until that CTR is in there. But if I think I have enough support with the capsule hooks, I'll try and remove the cortex before I put the CTR in. But I always use bimanual IAs in these cases. I love bimanual IA. two paracenteses, one irrigator, one aspirator.
That's a great pearl. Wow, that's a great pearl.
So it just gives you full access. Much control. Full access, you never struggle, and you can either reverse strip and you can tangential strip very easily all the way around the capsule. But again, you're going to have to switch sides at one point. So the IAs come out, you switch hands, you go back in, and during that switch, you've got to refill the eye with OBD. Again, you can't let the chamber shallow. So I love bimanual. It gives you some experience using your right and left hand. No such thing as subincisional, and it can really get you out of a jam. So if I think the cortex is going to come out easily, and as I'm stripping cortex, I'm not seeing the equator of the bag come in. I'm sure you've been there, right? You're stripping cortex. You're like, oh, geez, that's really a clear red reflex. I think I'm seeing the equator. Right. Then you're done. You know, fill the bag, fill it with OBD so it's all, there's no wrinkles. Put the CTR in right away, you know. And then if you struggle a little bit getting cortex out, it's better than Braken's annuals. But there are some modified CTRs. The Henderson modification has these little Bonnie Henderson. Kind of cool. It doesn't put as much tension. You know, it gives little gaps out there, so maybe it's a bit easier for stripping cortex. But usually with the bimanual IA, if the CTR is in or out, you've got more control. You can make smaller moves, and you can usually get that cortex out of there. And then once it's out, more OVD goes in. Viscoelastic, your best friend in these cases.
Wow, I mean, note to self for me. Sometimes I'll be doing these cases, and I'll just say, well, no, just give me the IA, and it's like the coaxial. And I need to take a step back and say, wait, give me the side port blade. Let me make another para. Please give me the bimanual IA instruments.
And you know what you can do in a jam? And I was just, our fellow today was struggling with this. Great surgeon. Subincisional cortex is a problem for everybody sometimes, right? It's just a pain in the neck, right? You can just take, you can take the aspirator off your bimanual. You don't always have to make a second paracentesis. You can use your IA as the irrigator and just take the aspirator from the bimanual, go through your para, get subincisional, and then you're done. So you don't always have to make that like second that. Para. You just like do a little.
Unplug your aspiration line from your IA handpiece. Use the infusion line in your regular coaxial IA handpiece. Go in the main incision for infusion. Yep. Get the aspirator and put that on your aspiration line.
Yep.
Through the side port, and then just go, and there's no extra incision.
There you go. Yep.
Oh, I like
it's a,
it.
It's a little fake it by manual. Now, what will happen is you'll get passive backflow of BSS or aqueous through the aspirator.
Yeah.
So it leaks into your lap a little bit. So you don't want to do it too long or you get all wet. But for just a couple seconds to help get subincisional, works really well. And maybe we should design a little cap that we can put on the aspiration line so it doesn't leak out. We'll call it the Ayers Devgan or Devgan Ayers cap.
That's too funny. But I think
we're retiring.
That's a great idea. No, you got to take a step back and think of these cases. Okay, so now you've got the capsule bag is supported by these four hooks. You've got a CTR in it. It's totally empty. By some stroke of luck, you got all the cortex out. Do you put a single piece in the bag? Do you put a three-piece in the sulcus with optic capture? What are you doing now?
Yeah, so the answer is yes. You know, you do something. I actually would put a single piece in the bag. That's how I do. I've got my CTR in there. It's holding the bag open. There's no harm in putting a three-piece in the bag, or you could put a three-piece in the sulcus. I think a lot of surgeons would promote three-piece in the sulcus, optic capture. So you've got your optic captured in the bag. You've got your haptics up in the sulcus. Maybe that decreases your chances for late subluxation. Myself, I typically just put the lens in the bag. I love single piece acrylic IOLs because they just go in so easily.
Yeah.
Three piece IOLs can sometimes be a challenge to get in. You can get a big haptic sweep. You can end up tearing the bag. You can disinsert things. So unless you're really used to that, the maneuver of rotating your inserter or using a three piece that goes in very planar, you could be at the last step of your surgery, and all of a sudden you find you're just at the beginning because you've disinserted the bag with a CTR inside it, which is even a bigger challenge. So for me, single piece acrylic goes in the bag, and then we decide, you know, do we need to do something more to support the zonules, or
like what? Like what would you do?
Well, So you could use, if your CTR happened to have eyelets like a Sione 1 or a Sione 2, you could suture the capsular tension ring. I like to use the Ahmed segments. Looks a little bit like a coat hanger, about a third of a capsular tension ring, has a little eyelet that comes up on top of the capsular bag, and we can either proline or Gore-Tex suture that to the sclera.
So that's an addition to the, so IOL's in the bag, CTR's in the bag, and now segments in the bag.
And or now two segments. One or two segments. I would say with pseudoexfoliation, probably two, because again, global zonulopathy. Sometimes with a traumatic case, you may get away with one. Sometimes with Marfan syndrome, where you've got stretched zonules, you might get away with just one segment.
And how do you like to secure this Ahmed segment? Do you like to use Gore-Tex? Do you like to use the larger proline with flanges? Do you like to use a teno proline? What do you like to do here?
So it used to be teno polypropylene. It will disinsert on you. Now, it's easy. It's an easy technique. And in an older patient, it might give you enough time. I'd say you've got 10 or 15. Yeah, 10 to 15, and it's gonna break and hydrolyze on you. I've been using Gore-Tex for I don't even know how long anymore. I love Gore-Tex. It doesn't disinsert. It doesn't break. It surgically is quite friendly. So I like Gore-Tex fixation, but a lot of people are transitioning to 5-0 proline, where you kind of Yamani it, if you will, where you use the proline, flange, put a nub on it, and flange it, pull it through. Great techniques. Cannabrava, you know, kind of started that technique, and then it's been modified, and Kathy McCabe has done a lot of work on that as well. So that certainly is a little less work in the anterior segment, and not everybody has access to Gore-Tex. So I think either one of those techniques is probably fine. But myself, I love Gore-Tex. I'm used to it, and so that's usually what I reach for.
Well, a couple of pearls here. As we both agreed, the 10-0 polypropylene is fantastic for about 10 years. After that, no dice. So your patient's 85, you're good to go.
You're good to go, exactly.
The Gore-Tex is going to probably last you forever. The catch there is, if you haven't worked with it before, it's 8-0 Gore-Tex, as small as I can get at least.
Yep.
And then when you tie it, it is slick. It's slippery. You better tie that tightly and double and triple check your knot so it doesn't unravel. And if you are going to do a flange technique with 5-0 or 6-0 proline, like Cannabrava, like McCabe, both fantastic surgeons, we've had videos for both of them, by the way, on Cataract Coach already, make sure the flanges are not just sitting there subconj, ready to poke through the conj. Those flanges need to be buried within the scleral tunnels that you've created.
Yeah, like you mentioned, Uday, these techniques are a little bit different. You've got to sort of know how to work with each of these materials because they're all a little bit different. They kind of have their own advantages and disadvantages. And the slippery nature of Gore-Tex is the disadvantage. Another name for Gore-Tex is Teflon, right? That Teflon coating is Gore-Tex coating. It is super slippery. I may, you know, in the OR, it may come out that it's like snot on a doorknob. You know, it is really, really slick. And
I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, it's really slippery, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
Right.
So, yeah. So so you got to tie your knots carefully. And when you go to bury the knot, it's a different technique than you're used to when you're burying a 10-0 nylon or a 10-0 polypropylene.
What's your technique? Tell us.
I grab the knot, right? So I do 4 or 5 throws in these knots.
Yeah.
Gore-Tex is filled with air. The reason it's white is because there's air pockets in it. Those air pockets make it, it's monofilament with air pockets. And when you squish it, that's why it flattens out when you squish it. And when it gets wet, it turns almost clear. So I tie the knot. You make sure it's tight. Make sure the air is out of the knot. Cut them short, and then I actually grab the knot itself with a micro forcep or a fine tire, and you just shove the knot right into the sclerotomy. I'm not pulling on the Gore-Tex suture and trying to rotate it in. You're shoving it in, and that way it doesn't slip on you and it doesn't untie. I've untied Gore-Tex unintentionally trying to bury it the way I would bury a 10-0 nylon. And then it's really frustrating because you've got this little teeny piece of Gore-Tex that's now come untied and you're trying to tie this little itty-bitty baby knot. And it's
impossible.
It's just not going to work. It's just not going to happen. So watch videos, watch Cataract Coach. How do you bury a Gore-Tex knot? It is a little bit different. It's not hard. It's just different. And it's got its own technique, and if you do it right, it's going to work well for you. But that knot has got to be buried. An exposed Gore-Tex knot will come through.
Erode.
It will become exposed, and you can try anything you want. It will erode through anything. So you either got to replace it or bury it. So bury it, do it right. And I put a suture through the sclerotomy, holding the Gore-Tex knot so it can't somehow back rotate. So I always sutured that sclerotomy.
Like, what do you suture that with?
Typically, adovicral on a vascular needle, because the needle can cut the Gore-Tex too. So I would use a BV needle on an adovicral or something like that, and I close that sclerotomy.
Such great pros. Yeah, for your normal suture, like we're used to suturing tenno nylon and a cornea incision or scleral incision, and then to rotate it, you just grab the suture itself and just push it, and the knot gets buried. You're right, though. For Gore-Tex, not going to work. You got to grab the knot itself with microforceps and bury the knot itself.
You got it. That's how you do it. And that technique will take you far with Gore-Tex.
I only learned that the hard way about like 8 or 10 years ago.
We've all done it. We've all done it. And I've cut my Gore-Tex with a side cutting needle on Vicryl. So just take the mistakes that we've made and don't make them anymore. I mean, that's what teaching is about. You know, take the problems we've run into and hopefully our students, fellows, colleagues don't run into those same roadblocks because we've already done it. And that way you can move to the next level instead of having to take all the struggles that we've gone through.
That is fantastic. Wow, I love just kind of working this case with you. I've learned so much. I mean, these pearls are so kind of burned into my head. What I'm going to do is we're going to feature your video as our Cataract Coach podcast on a Sunday coming up here. But I want to get a video from you to feature the day after on that Monday of kind of these similar types of techniques. I'm sure you'll send that to me.
Yeah.
But this is, incredible learning. I want to encourage all our viewers, all our listeners, you can handle these cases. It's just one foot in front of the other. Step by step, you'll be fine. Study in advance. Watch these videos. Plan it out in your head. Make notes. I'm not afraid in my OR to put up a picture of an eyeball that I've hand-drawn, showing where I'm going to do my incisions. I'll put a list of the steps that I want to do in the procedure. I'll put a note that says, okay, the Gore-Tex has got to be 4 throws, and I got to grab the knot to bury it. Make your game plan, and you'll be fine. And even if it doesn't pan out the way expected because of bad patient tissue, whatever else, you've got your vitreoretinal colleagues to help you.
100%. One more tip, Uday.
Tell me.
We have all hung this. This shows that we've actually done this, right? We've also hung up pictures of how to tie a knot. You know, a little graphic, a little picture, stuck it to the microscope, and then I sat down at that microscope. But when I adjusted the scope, the arm of the scope bent, and it put the picture the wrong way, so I couldn't see it. So make sure you know how the scope is going to be oriented during the case, where you put your pictures or your hints or your tips so that you can actually see it while you're operating.
Well, I'll give you one more pearl. When I draw the picture of the eye, I don't put it in front of me. I put it behind the patient's head. So the right eye is on the right side, the left eye is on the left side, and it's drawn appropriately. So when I there's no need to flip it in my head.
Yeah,
because that way I don't get like the mirror image and anything. I don't get any confusion. I usually put the picture on the wall behind the patient's head, right eye on the right side, left eye on the left side.
That's good. So, yeah, that's probably better. And that doesn't move when you move the scope, so that's probably better than what I did. Yeah, man, that was terrible.
I also want to emphasize to our viewers who are watching, especially if you're a younger surgeon, less than 10 years of practice experience, when we show these complex cases, they're edited. Now, if you go to cataractcoach.com, you click on, there's a complete list of videos, and you go to the complete cataract cases, all those are unedited. Those are all me operating, all unedited. But otherwise, we edit video. And when you watch that 5-minute case of like, oh yeah, this, that, boom, that's a 30 or 45-minute case that's been edited to 5 minutes. Take your time. It doesn't matter how long the case takes. I mean, that's an important point.
Yep, you're right. You're right, Uday.
Yeah, it's just like, there's sometimes we just watch these videos and like, okay, it looks that easy. I should be able to do this in 10 minutes. Yeah, you know. Take your time.
These cases take a while. I'm pretty happy if I look up and we're done these cases in 30 minutes. I mean, that's a high five when we're out of there. You've got to move slow. You can't do quick motions in the eye. And it's going to take longer the first time or two that you do it. You're not used to handling the instruments.
Yeah.
You're learning a lot of ergonomics. So, take your time. And we have a few videos, and we should do this maybe too, Uday, where some of the video is showing the surgeon's hands. Because we always show the microscope view, what's happening in the OR. But you might not realize that I'm holding instruments like, exactly, like this, or I've almost got it in my teeth. So, because that's a lot of the magic is how you're approaching the eye and how you're holding an instrument. Because it can be very different. And when all you see is a chopper going into the eye, you don't quite get what's going on all around, right? The OR is there's five or six people in there working on this patient, and all you're seeing is that microscope view. And sometimes that hides some of the challenges and some of the tricks that we're doing. So I love getting these videos where it's actually also showing the surgeon's hands and positioning so you can see what we're doing.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Brandon, I got to tell you, for a challenging cataract case, you are my favorite guy to watch. I love watching videos. I do subscribe to your YouTube channel.
I know, and I subscribe to yours.
I'll put a link down below, but I think I encourage all cataract coach viewers, you got to check out Brandon's channel. There's so many girl pearls there to help you in these cases. Now, I would be remiss if I only talked about challenging case with you. I got to talk about like actual personal and fun stuff. Now, one of the things, whatever I see you in a meeting, we always talk about is mountain biking.
Absolutely.
I have a huge heart for mountain biking, but a minimal skill set. So I'm an absolute newbie mountain biker. But Brandon, you're like years ahead of me in this. Tell me about your experience with mountain biking.
So my experience with cycling goes way back. So when I was in grade school, I had a little KX80, a little Kawasaki, dirt bike, and it kept breaking down. So I'm like, Dad, my motorcycle keeps breaking down. Let's just sell it, and I'm going to buy a BMX bike. And so in, I think, fourth or fifth grade, I got a BMX bike. And ever since I bought that bike, I've never been off my bike again. I just rode BMX and BMX freestyle, did all kinds of local tournaments. And then as I grew up, so did the bicycles. I ended up, racing bicycles in college and after college, and then raced mountain bikes as well. So cycling is what keeps me from coming home and kicking the dog, So it's kind of my outlet. And I think it's important to have other outlets, whether it's art, music, athletics, besides just eyeballs. Because, man, this business can be all-encompassing. You know that, Uday, right? You can spend every minute talking and doing eyeball stuff. And you have to have something else that you do, some other passions. So I love being on my bike, and I still try and ride 150 to 200 miles a week. I just did a century the other day. I did the triple bypass last year with some of my buddies. And actually an ex-fellow, Jason Mayer, and shout out to Jason Mayer here on Cataract Coach. But I love it. So I love being on my bike. It gives me some great exercise, keeps me in shape, and it helps me. And then doing that helps me refocus what I'm doing in the office and in the operating room. I love bikes. And mountain biking is so fun. And the first for me, I did some gravel riding just the other day. A buddy of mine loaned me his bike, and I got my butt kicked. I'm not used to getting my butt kicked. I got lit up on this gravel ride. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun. Gravel riding, for those who don't know, it's kind of a mixture of a road bike and a mountain bike. So you're not doing quite as challenging of a trail, but you're still off-road and you're at a little bit of a higher speed. And it's a cool mix. It's something different to change up the day. And it was a lot of fun. But man, I was beat up after that ride, but it was a good time.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Well, I look forward to the day when you and I could go mountain biking or riding together. Just to don't leave me too far in the dust.
No problem. It'll be fun anytime.
Well, I want to thank you, Brandon. I really enjoyed our podcast. I love the way you think about a challenging case and how you approach it and kind of the stepwise approach. You had some incredible pearls today, very useful material. And I also have to thank you that it is past 10 p.m. your time. For those who are listening to the audio only, Brandon's still in scrubs. This is a very hardworking man. I am sincerely appreciative, and all our viewers sincerely appreciate such incredible words of wisdom. Thank you again.
Uday, thanks for having me. Cataract Coach is awesome. It's a great resource for all of us. Thank you so much for your time, and thanks for having me today.
Fantastic. And be sure to send me that video, which will feature the day after your podcast.
Will do.
And I want to remind our viewers and our listeners, remember, we've got a podcast every single week. Stay tuned next week for another great episode. Thank you for enjoying that podcast with me and Brandon Ayers. I like his approach to a complex cataract case, the way he thinks,
And we want to hear from you. Remember how we talked about in this podcast, what do you think is going to change in cataract surgery that 25 or 30 years from now we'll look back and say, wow, why did we do it that way? You know that my idea is, I think we're going to say, let's stop collapsing the capsular bag. Let's keep the capsular bag full and open. What do you think? Leave us a comment below. This is a really neat exercise. I bet we'll all learn together.